From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we talk about the spread of COVID in schools and how districts might approach the remaining weeks of the school year.
It would be good if, in the future, schools could learn lessons from this that might allow less crowding, you know, more distancing, etc. I can't imagine a future where every student's needing to wear a mask all the time. I don't think that's going to happen.
Then we explore Ernest Hemingway's summers in northern Michigan.
When they came up here to northern Michigan, it was kind of, everything was open as far as skinny dipping in the lake and a little bit of extra freedom. It's dark and kids get to do what kids do after dark. And to me, that's just sort of the quintessential summer story.
And the effect of Hemingway's work on a young Michigan woman he knew, fictionalized in his work.
Biographers said things about Marge without even knowing her, without ever contacting her.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, some fresh thoughts about Ernest Hemingway as audiences are getting reacquainted with his work and legacy in a new PBS documentary. Did you know that some of Hemingway's characters were named after people he knew in his Michigan boyhood? More on that later in the show. But first, a number of Michigan school districts are doing their best to navigate recommendations for in-person learning now that the picture for COVID infections has darkened. As we've discussed over the past couple of days, the state's hospitalizations have hit their highest point since December, and there were 11,000 brand new cases reported Monday. Detroit, Dearborn, and Traverse City's public schools have all put face-to-face learning on pause for a week. Kids are definitely top of mind amid all this. Dr. B. Keith English is chair of the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development at Michigan State University. He's also on the board of the Michigan chapter for the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. English, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
We've heard reports of younger people being hospitalized in the past few weeks, folks in their 20s, their 30s, and their 40s. Are you aware of increases in the hospitalization of children?
Yes, this is a disturbing trend nationwide. I'd say a couple of things have happened. We've seen more cases being reported in children, particularly teenagers and preteens around the country, not just in Michigan, but around the country. And that has also resulted in more hospitalizations. It's still the case that children are less likely to become severely ill than particularly elderly adults or adults with underlying medical conditions, but we are seeing an increase in even more serious infections in children.
What have you learned about the long-term effects that COVID has on children? I mean, beyond just hospitalizations, it seems like there's a bit more to keep in mind here, right?
That's right. So there, we know more about long-term effects in adults because more adults have been sick and more adults have been followed for a long period of time. We are concerned, though, that there's some evidence that there will be long-term effects in children as well. And they're not only in the more severely ill people, although they are more common. Even mild infection sometimes results in complications down the road. And as we learn more about this, there are even more reasons to do our best to prevent these infections.
Part of what's driving the increase in infections right now is the B.1.1.7 variant, and it just seems to have arrived in Michigan at exactly the same time schools that had been doing remote learning were returning to the classroom in many places. With that return, we have seen quite a few infections of COVID spreading among school-age students and teachers, even with safety precautions in place. Our understanding is that a lot of these cases may be related to sports, but, you know, it seems like we can't rule out classrooms. Do you think that that should give us pause for how we approach the remaining weeks of the school year?
Well, yes, it should give us pause and we should be concerned. You know, I'll start by saying I certainly agree with parents and pediatric leaders that we should be doing everything we can to try to have kids back in the learning environment. We know how much children have suffered during this past year from not being able to be in school. It really does result in serious consequences. At the same time, we have to be worried about these recent increases in cases, particularly, as I mentioned earlier, in teenagers and preteens. And that does mean that's a tough balancing act. There's no easy answer here, and there's no one right answer. I'll comment on something that you just said a minute ago. I think that's correct, is that there is evidence around the country, including in Michigan, that certain events may be associated with spread amongst children, particularly preteens and teenagers. Sporting events in particular have been singled out. But even there, most of the evidence is it's probably not transmission occurring on the field, just like most of the transmission related to schools is not occurring in the classroom. It's probably occurring more when children are congregating, whether, you know, it's after an athletic event or after school or et cetera. It's more likely that that's going to result in spread than in situations where there's some distancing and other measures are being taken to reduce the spread.
What concerns you the most as we head towards summer?
I think it's this race between getting enough people immunized and more spread of these more contagious variants. You know, some of the variants may also be more severe, but a couple of them for sure are more contagious and more likely to spread. And so, you know, I'm just worried that what really concerns me right now is that we don't want to lose any opportunity for people to be immunized. We've had good progress in Michigan and many states now with a high percentage of adults, older adults in particular, being immunized, but we're not doing well enough. We need to really get everybody who, you know, who qualifies to encourage them strongly to be immunized. I am worried about vaccine hesitancy, and I'm worried about that once these vaccines are approved for use in younger children. I hope parents and families will be planning to have their children immunized once vaccines are approved for children less than 16 years of age. As you know now, one of the three vaccines in the United States is approved for use at age 16, the other two vaccines at age 18. There is some data already accumulating suggesting the vaccines are safe and effective down to age 12. It's not yet approved for age 12. And everything we know makes it very likely these vaccines will be effective in young children. But we don't have the data yet, and we don't know how long it's going to take before those vaccines are approved. But preemptively, I want to make sure parents understand how important it will be to have your children immunized once it's available for younger children.
Do you think we need to be realistic about how many parents might change their minds, having been resistant to flu vaccinations for their kids or chickenpox vaccinations or tetanus shots for their kids? What new cases can be made that have not been made before?
Yes, we do need to be realistic. I would say there's good news and there's bad news about vaccine hesitancy. The bad news is many parents are hesitant to immunize their children, mainly because they have been provided with incorrect information about the risk of the vaccine or the risk of the diseases. The good news is that there is considerable evidence that many families who are hesitant about vaccines will decide to immunize their kids based on a good relationship with their physician. So the physician relationship with the patient and the family is the key. And in many cases, hesitant families will decide to immunize their kids when they have a good relationship with their doctor. I do want to say that vaccine hesitancy is common, but vaccine refusal is not that common. There aren't that many people who absolutely refuse to immunize their children. That's a small percentage of Americans. The bigger problem is the folks who are hesitant. And again, those are the ones who can be persuaded to immunize their kids if it's in the context of a relationship with their doctor.
Do you think that the COVID vaccines will be cleared for use in younger children, say below the age of 12?
Yes, but it may be many months. I mean, I think what's likely to happen is one or more of the vaccines will be approved for use down to age 12, hopefully by this summer. The vaccines are being tested currently in children down to 6 months of age, but it may be months. And, you know, this is the opposite of the way vaccines usually are developed, right? I mean, most vaccines in common use are given to young children because that's how they're developed and tested, because most infectious diseases are more common and more dangerous in young children. COVID has been different than that. It's about the only good thing you can say about COVID is that it has not generally been as severe, particularly in younger children, as it has been in older children and certainly elderly adults. So it's been peculiar, but there's every reason to think the vaccine will be safe and effective in infants and children, but there's not enough data yet, you know, to start giving it.
I did want to ask you a bit about what you just mentioned. As any parent, and I'm sure any pediatrician can attest, schools have always been and probably will remain a place where viruses and bugs get spread. Do you think there should be any permanent changes in how our schools think about health and safety precautions? I mean, I've talked to people who say they feel like whenever they go shopping from now on, period, they're going to wear that mask. Do you think that schools might be rethinking their hygiene practices, maybe at least over the winter months?
You know, that's a very good question. And, you know, you could ask a similar question about, you know, how the practice of medicine may change in the future. I do think schools will think through ways to reduce transmission of other viruses in the future. I do think it would be good if in the future schools could learn lessons from this that might allow less crowding, you know, more distancing, et cetera. I can't imagine a future where every student's needing to wear a mask all the time. I don't think that's going to happen. And I will say one other thing, that while it's a good idea to, you know, have a clean school and to clean your doorknob at home, et cetera, there's very little evidence that this virus spreads from contaminated surfaces. There's never been any strong evidence. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's very unlikely. This is a virus that spread when you're near somebody else that's infected and they're coughing or they're speaking loudly, et cetera, and from those droplets that occur. And most of that's from being close to someone like that.
Right. I read recently that your colleague, Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha, a prominent pediatrician who practices in Flint, suggesting that Michigan needs a vaccination surge right now and also needs a 2-week pause in everything else. I'm assuming by that she meant school. Do you agree?
I think Mona is right in that she's saying we need to carefully consider everything we're doing. We may have to pause some things that we were planning to do. You know, it's just a difficult time right now. I don't want to say one size fits all, because the problem is the situation's not the same in every school district in every part of the state. But I will say this, we need to redouble our efforts to socially distance and to wear a mask and avoid other people. I mean, socially distancing is the most important thing, right? If you're not near somebody else, the fact that you're not wearing a mask isn't as important. It's when you're close to someone and you're not wearing a mask, that's when there's transmission. So avoiding large events. Schools may be able to still be open safely, but there can't be places where kids are congregating together. This is not a time to be complacent.
Dr. Keith English is chair of the Department of Pediatrics and Human Development at Michigan State University. Dr. English, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As a young person, Ernest Hemingway spent many summers in northern Michigan, and much of his writing reflects on his time among the waters and forests near Petoskey. He chose up north to recuperate after being wounded in World War I, and he started his career as a writer of fiction there. It was the scene of his first wedding. The new documentary by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, titled Hemingway, premiered this week on PBS. And here to talk more with us about Hemingway's Michigan roots is Christopher Struble. He's president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Christopher, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's quite an honor.
Will you paint a picture for us of the area where Hemingway spent his summers?
Yeah, it's kind of just like it is now. We have these beautiful lakes that were carved out when the glaciers retreated 10,000 years ago, all this fresh water. And that was a boom for tourism in the 1890s. Lumbering had pretty much cleared the whole area, and they were looking for a way to revitalize the area, and tourism was the way. And they sent out a lot of promo stuff to Kansas City, Chicago, and St. Louis. And, of course, the Hemingways were one of those families that came from the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois, and found their way up here the first time in 1898. Dr. Clarence Hemingway and his wife, Grace, who was an opera singer who actually made a little bit more money than her husband did. They rode the lake that morning before they headed out, and they found a beautiful piece of land that was 375 feet long, beautiful sloping sandy beach. They had a child and then one on the way, and they wanted to make sure when they returned the next summer in 1899, Hemingway's first year up here, that they had a nice, safe beach. Dr. Clarence Hemingway was always concerned about the children drowning over the years, so he picked what I would consider probably the best beach on all of Walloon. They paid around $250 for 375 feet. If you were to compare that to today's average, it's about $14,000 a foot out there when you have parcels of 100 feet or more. So pretty good investment.
My gosh. Do folks who are in the area and who've lived there a long time, do you run into folks who remember Hemingway today?
You know, we do. He's 123 years old. 100. So it's this summer would be 122. So 123rd year he would have been up here. But we still have a few people that remember him or remembering him. You know, so these memories get a little convoluted a little bit. Ernest Mainland, who was his nephew, he just passed away this year, and he was one of the only family members that actually are still alive that met Hemingway. But he often said that he's not sure if his memories were his own or memories that he heard afterwards, you know, from his mother. And then we had a local legend here, Irene Gordon. So in the time that I've lived in northern Michigan, Irene Gordon and Judge Ned Fenlon both lived to be collectively like 107 years old. So I've heard Ned Fenlon say that damn Hemingway stole my girlfriend from me. Must be something in the water up here as far as longevity.
Yeah. You have said that it's hard to find a Hemingway story that doesn't mention Michigan to some degree. Let's start with one that's actually titled Up in Michigan.
Yeah, great one.
Yeah, this was perhaps one of his more controversial, especially for its time.
That's saying something for Hemingway, right? One of his most controversial.
Right. Where did it take place?
It, you know, I was talking with the owners last night. It took place in Horton Bay at the Dilworth Cottage. And the Dilworth Cottage is were comprised of Shangri-La and Pinehurst. And they served chicken dinners there. It was one of the more well-known resort communities in northern Michigan. And it was just three houses kind of combined there. The houses are still almost exactly as they were during Hemingway's time. Shangri-La is actually for rent. It's a summer rental. And it's one of those places where you can really experience Hemingway. It's one of those rare opportunities to sit there and read Hemingway in a house where Hemingway would have sat while he was thinking about writing Hemingway. It's a really, really unique locale. Very much preserved the way it was. There's a lot of wetlands there. And so just by happenstance, some of these areas have been preserved with no connection to Hemingway just because of the way things happened. So it's just, it's really cool how authentic the area is up here to this day.
Let's listen to a clip from the Ken Burns and Lynn Novick documentary titled Hemingway.
I think Up in Michigan is very important because, first of all, he is saying there are no boundaries. I'm going to write with no boundaries, no restrictions. I'm not going to listen to you, polite world. I'm going to what I think is true, but I'm going to see it from the point of view of the woman.
Liz Coates is a teenaged girl working in a boarding house in the tiny town of Horton's Bay. Among the boarders is a handsome young blacksmith named Jim Gilmore. One evening, they go down to the dock.
"Don't, Jim," Liz said. Jim slid the hand further up. "You mustn't, Jim. You mustn't." Neither Jim nor Jim's big hand paid any attention to her.
The story concerns Jim Gilmore, a blacksmith who comes to Horton's Bay, and Liz Coates, a young woman who's got a crush on him. At risk of giving away the plot of the story, there's a rape involved. And there are a real Jim and Liz, I understand, who were in fact very dear family friends and had cottages where Hemingway would stay. Do you have any idea of how folks in the area reacted to that story, or, you know, sort of the mores that were reflected in it?
Yeah, so I mean, for its time, Gertrude Stein said this story is unpublishable, even in that time. And of course, now with the cancel culture, who knows, you know, how that would be perceived. But you know, we kind of try to take things in context of when it was written, but even at that time, it was still controversial. Jim and Liz were great family friends of the Hemingways, and it's interesting that Hemingway often wrote in several stories that it wasn't time to talk about these things because these people were still alive. But yet, Up in Michigan, which was first written in 1921, the same year he would have stayed there for his wedding, he chose to use Jim and Liz by their first name. And in the original copy, he actually had the Dilworth's name written there, but he penciled that out and then change it to Gilmore. So he really was, you know, incorporating them into the story. But that was part of his whole writing technique, was to write what you really know. And those early sketches that were so great were really things that he had experienced throughout his life. Now, of course, this scenario that happens in the story, again, without giving out the plot, it never took place. They were already a married, established couple by the time Hemingway met them, and he called them Uncle Jim and Aunt Liz. And when the story came out, there was quite a bit of controversy, not so much locally, but more internationally. And then, of course, this was the first of two big fallouts that happened in that summer with his parents. When his mother read the story, she couldn't believe that he had incorporated the names, and his sister Marceline felt the same way. You know, these were family friends, and to put them in that scenario was kind of a little bit, just maybe a little bit taboo.
Did Ernest Hemingway ever say why he did that?
You know, he didn't, and it kind of goes back to another story that involves Marge Bump. And we're talking with Marge, and that was another kind of controversial story about a breakup of a relationship that never happened. And Marge, her son's 91 years old. He's one of those people that still remembers meeting Hemingway. And Hemingway made a visit to their house in Florida in the 50s. And the talk of the table that evening was, why did you use my real name? And he was always usually very particular about not really, you know, divulging who the actual person was. He would change names around a little bit, but yet here Marge Bump shows up as Marge Bump. As Sid remembers, Hemingway proceeded to drink all the gin in the house, and then they settled the score and everything was fine. But for some reason, in those two stories, he chose to use actual people, even though he was very sensitive about the fact that that could be a little bit off limits. But you know, Jim and Liz, they kind of responded with a laugh. Here, he's a blacksmith, the real Jim, and the real Liz, and she serves chicken dinners at the Dilworth Cottage. And all of a sudden, here they are in the center of a international kind of controversy, a literary controversy, and they thought it was a little bit humorous, actually.
Jeez. There are other stories, Summer People from the Nick Adams series, and also Wedding Day. And Northern Michigan was the site of the actual wedding luncheon for Hemingway and his bride at the time, Hadley Richardson. Do you have a favorite Michigan-specific story in the canon?
Yeah, and you just mentioned it, and it's actually probably the first time that Nick Adams appears in fiction, and that's Summer People. That's one of my favorite stories, and it just really captures that freedom that he always talked about in Northern Michigan. You know, he came from a kind of a strict and regimented upbringing, so much in Oak Park to a certain extent. But when they came up here to Northern Michigan, it was kind of, you know, everything was open as far as skinny dipping in the lake and a little bit of extra freedom. It's dark and kids get to do what kids do after dark. And to me, that's just sort of the quintessential summer story. And if you were to kind of really analyze The Sun Also Rises and compare it to Summer People, you'll see so many similarities between those stories, in my opinion. And it was just the first one that really caught my attention. And it's probably one of my all-time favorite stories, right behind The Sun Also Rises, coincidentally. Yeah, so Summer People would be my favorite Nick Adams story and Michigan sketch. And when you walk down that beach and that stretch of road today, it's just like it was at that time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with president of the Michigan Hemingway Society, Christopher Strubel. He's giving us sort of a verbal tour through some of the favorite woods and forests that Ernest Hemingway visited and enjoyed up north. I'm inferring from something you said earlier that the Hemingway cottage has never left the family?
No, it went to Hemingway after his father committed suicide, unfortunately, in 1928. Hemingway officially took ownership in 1935. Even though it was deeded to him or unofficially deeded to him at the passing of Clarence. And then when Hemingway passed away, it laid in limbo for a little while longer until his sister, Sunny, took over the cottage. And she lived there until her passing. And then it transferred to her only son, who was Hemingway's namesake, Ernest Miller Hemingway Mainland, who just recently passed away, unfortunately, a few months ago. So it's still in the family, and just kind of wondering what's going to happen in the next generation.
Is there any clarity about the estate at this point?
No, it's just a little too soon to sort of make these inquisitions, and so we're just or inquiries. I'm sorry, but we're just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, what would you like to see happen with it?
You know, at one time I thought it was really going to transfer to one of the major universities in the country, and there was a little bit of scandal involved with that university, and I was kind of maybe sidestepped that a little bit, but I'd love to see it preserved in a way that could be shared by the scholars and the fans of Hemingway. and still maybe remain in possession of the family to a certain extent also. Kind of looking for the perfect balance would be my preference. It's just such an honor when you get a chance to go in there. And over the last 3-4 decades, it's not uncommon to have people show up out front. And of course, everybody wants to see this, that's a Hemingway fan, but looking at it from the point of the former owner, Ernie Mainland, one time he was in the shower and he remembers hearing people in the living room. He came out and here's this group of tourists in his front living room. So it's on the state of historic, or it's on the list of historical residences in the United States, but it's still a private residence.
Wait, they just walked in?
They just walked in. And when he told them they had to leave, they said, well, we're going to talk to the neighbors about this. Kind of.
Is the cottage, as Ernie Mainland maintained it, has it changed very much from the days when Ernest Hemingway spent time there?
No, but that's not without some tender, loving care. In 1997, I want to say, they started some major renovations. The place sat pretty much vacant for, probably the better part of 20 years, maybe even a little longer. And as places in northern Michigan, this happens in a nice, moist, wet environment with heavy winters. The cottage suffered quite a bit of internal damage and some stuff with the foundation. And they started a very comprehensive renovation process in the 1997 period, which was finished by the time of 1999, which was the centennial of Hemingway's birth. And that's when I first toured the cottage. But they painstakingly really took great care to maintain all the integrity of the cottage. And there's traces of him throughout the cottage. That there's no doubt about that.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah. So when Hemingway was wounded in World War I, one of the things that he was known for was he was a bit superstitious and he always wore a good luck charm. And that fateful day, he had a Oak Park track medal on his chest. He was wearing on a chain as a good luck charm. And that piece suffered quite a bit of damage from a piece of shrapnel that would have been a fatal wound to the chest. And they have that framed, and it's in the cottage right next to the windowsill where he used to sleep. There's little marks around the house where Clarence had stopped doors from swinging because the cottage was slightly off level. I'd say all in all, when you're inside the cottage, you're looking at about 90% authenticity of the time of Hemingway's time in the cottage, right down to the thing that caught me the most. And I really appreciated this because in my childhood, we did the same as many people do in their cottages. There's a board next to the door and it shows all the family members at different heights throughout the summers that they spent there. And that's preserved as it was. And Hemingway's final marker was probably about 6'1".
You take people on walking tours of people come from all over the world, really, to come see the waters and the forests that Hemingway loved and that he wrote about. Christopher, has the land changed very much in all these years?
So we have places that obviously have changed, but when you get out to Horton Bay for the Nick Adams tour, which is a more extensive tour that we do, it's probably like a 2.5-hour tour. We go out to Hemingway country. Really, the only thing that's changed out there is the trees are a little bit taller. You know, the lumbering years did quite a bit of damage up here. And when Hemingway was here, it was kind of that second growth kind of coming up. And the one thing we say now is we pretty much have the authentic setting in the woods, but the trees are a little bit taller. Now, in 1905, his mother purchased a big piece of property on the opposite side of the land, of the lake, and it was about 1,700 feet of property, again, for a really good value. And it was a 40-acre farm, and she ultimately built her own cottage over there. The cottage still stands, but Longfield Farm, which is what they called the farm at that time, that's pretty much mega million mansions, you know, cottages, these amazing summer cottages there. So that piece of property has very much been developed. But just to the west of that is Camp Michigania, the University of Michigan's retreat, summer retreat. And they've accumulated a lot of that Hemingway farm property. So that's all pristine and preserved the way it was during Hemingway's time.
Hmm. Is there a favorite place that you go to when you need a little time away?
Yeah, and that's the nice thing is you can slip out of town here and you can hit Horton Bay. And within 15 minutes of leaving downtown Petoskey, you can find yourself at the Nick Adams Preserve. Walk down to Horton Creek and you can really experience that setting that he would have loved. Pretty much what he captures in the big Two-Hearted River, the same essence is right there in Horton Bay as we speak. And then if I'm really lucky and really fortunate, I spend a couple, 3 or 4 days in Shangri-La, one of the Dilworth's cottages, and read Hemingway while I'm sitting on the couch next to the stairway that he sneaks up after his liaison in Summer People.
Christopher Struble is president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Christopher, thanks so much for telling us a little bit more about these areas and what makes them special.
Well, thank you for having me. And again, this is my passion up here. And when it comes to Hemingway, I appreciate Cuba and Spain and Paris and all the places he's known to have spent so much time. But it was those 23 consecutive years that he spent here in Northern Michigan that I think really shaped not only his writing, but really had a major influence on his personal life also.
As we were just talking about before the break, the idyllic landscapes of northern Michigan became the setting for some of Ernest Hemingway's best-known short stories, published over the years and compiled in a collection called the Nick Adams Stories, more than a decade after Hemingway died. Some students at West Bloomfield High School have been reading Hemingway, and they discovered letters from one of his protagonists, Marjorie Bump. They have had a chance to transcribe these letters to get a better understanding of the people who inspired the stories. With us to talk more about the Marjorie Bump Letters Project are Jennifer Tynan and Yael Mizrahi. Jennifer's an English teacher at West Bloomfield and secretary of the Michigan Hemingway Society, and Yael, a sophomore and honors American Lit student, is one of her pupils. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer, for those who might not have caught up, who was Marjorie Bump in real life?
Marjorie Bump was a friend of Ernest Hemingway's who had met him when she was a young teenager in Petoskey. She was part of a gang of friends that Ernest Hemingway had up in Petoskey when he would go and live at Windermere during the summers there. There was a big gang of friends that he talks about throughout his own biographical remembrances. And then also they pop up throughout the Nick Adams stories. Sometimes he names them and then sometimes he renames them in fictional form.
I understand there was some dispute over whether or not Ernest Hemingway and Marjorie Bump ever had a thing going on. Do you have a perspective on that?
That's a complicated answer, because there's many answers to that question. Marge Bump's daughter, Georgiana Dickinson, wrote a book called Pip Pip to Hemingway, where Marge answers that question one way. Marge answers that question differently in the letters that we're working with, and I don't really know that I have the correct answer.
So let's just call that one a big gray area.
It is a big gray area, but I think that it's important that whatever it was, I don't think that it progressed very much past a high school romance. Let me just put it that way. I think it's important to note that it certainly wasn't anything salacious, and it certainly wasn't anything very intense.
Sure. And just to continue the thread, Marjorie Bump was a character who turned up in some of Hemingway's stories. Yael, you read the Nick Adams story, The Big Two-Hearted River, in addition to the Marge Bump stories, The End of Something and The Three-Day Blow. For those who haven't read the stories, what kind of character is Marge Bump in the stories?
Well, she's only actually in the story as a character in The End of Something. She is seen as Hemingway's, as Ms. Tynan said, either like a fling or a friendship. It's not very clear, but she's seen as a strong woman. She knows what she wants. She's smart. Sometimes that intimidates Nick Adams. But in the three-day blow, it's just Bob and Nick recovering from the breakup or the split. So you don't really see her much there, but they do reference her.
Jennifer, the world of Hemingway's time was not always kind to women who were assertive, and for that matter, women who had a lot of agency over their romantic lives. Could you tell us a little bit about, I guess, how readers reacted to Marjorie Bump when Hemingway published these stories, and how that may have colored the way people reacted to the real life Marjorie Bump?
It was not so much readers as much as it was biographers that did the damage, and the small town of Petoskey that had tongues wagging, so to speak. In the story, Marjorie, as Yael mentioned, comes across as a very strong woman, and Nick is the one, he breaks up with her, and Nick is left crying on the blanket. And she rows off, you know, into the distance, needs no help, no tears shed. She's done. And it's really a powerful story where she walks away looking victorious in this rowboat. And Bill is egging Nick on that, you know, he's escaped the clutches of marriage. And actually the one who gets trashed in the 3-day blow is Marge's mother. But afterwards, biographers said things about Marge without even knowing her, without ever contacting her, calling her this well-built waitress. They took the name Bump and made certain assumptions about her figure, about her standing in the town. They decried her as being low class. Bill had made some reference to that. And there's some literary criticism from Dr. Stoneback and Dr. Diker, who are preeminent Hemingway scholars, that rebut that vociferously. And that has, I think, helped to turn the tide against a long, long history of scholarship that paints Marjorie as some sort of vixen or some sort of, you know, tramp. And I welcome that, and I welcome the opportunity to set the record straight on that, because a lot of that information is just plain incorrect. The other thing that I challenged my students about, it bothered Marjorie to no end that she could not remain anonymous once those stories were published, because her real name was used in the stories. And instantly everyone in Petoskey was wondering just what had gone on between the two of them. So she moved. She got out of Petoskey and moved to Florida and burned all of her correspondence with Hemingway, because she didn't want that to be left after her death. But they maintained a friendship for the rest of Hemingway's life, at least.
Right. So there is no actual first-person narrative in the form of letters between Bump and Hemingway, but Marge was able to, you know, talk about this a little bit in some letters that she wrote to a bookseller who lived in New Hampshire. And those letters came into the possession of the Michigan Hemingway Society. And so that's what you're transcribing, isn't it, Jennifer?
Yes, it is. Those are the letters. And there is actually one letter at the Kennedy Library that it's a draft of a letter that Hemingway wrote to Marge that appears in the Penn State Letters Project and also in Pip Pip to Hemingway as well. That's the only correspondence that we know of that survives between the two of them. But it gives us a fascinating insight into Marge's thinking about the story, because Donald St. John, the bookseller, did interview Marge about every last conceivable memory she had of her time with Hemingway and what she thought of the stories and the fame and everything in between.
Yael, what did you find in these letters of Marjorie Bump? Like, how did she talk about the way she'd been painted?
Well, in the letter that I transcribed, she was telling the bookseller how there was a Hemingway documentary on TV and how they discussed how Hemingway painted a picture of his parents and how she did not like the way that he described them, that they were not like that. She seemed quite frustrated. She even said in my letter that she wants to erase all of Hemingway after 1920. So I think it really depends which letters you look at, but in mine for sure, she was not happy with the way that Hemingway was acting, and she described his personality as very know-it-all and not in a good light. But I'm sure that in some letters you'll see a different picture of Hemingway painted, but it's pretty clear that She was frustrated that her voice was basically silenced with these Nick Adams stories for the rest of her life.
Mm. It's easy to imagine how unpleasant this was for Marge Yale, but did you find any evidence that her place in Hemingway's fiction actually affected the course of her own life?
Well, yes. It's quite apparent that it affected her own life. She moved from the small town of Petoskey to Florida, got married, her last name changed. She even said in one of her letters that she wanted to be a writer and she wanted to use her voice, but she felt like she couldn't because of this picture that was already painted of her in the Nick Adams stories. So these letters are a way for her to find her own voice even after her death.
Yael Mizrahi is a sophomore at West Bloomfield. And we've also been talking with Jennifer Tynan. She's an English teacher and also secretary of the Michigan Hemingway Society. Jennifer, Yael, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for sharing a little bit about the project.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Detroit's anti-police brutality movement has scored some significant legal wins. Recently, a federal judge tossed out a city lawsuit filed against the protesters. The decision comes as hundreds of criminal charges against demonstrators were dismissed. Eli Newman brings us this story about how the city's case against the movement fell apart.
Throughout the summer of 2020, young marchers became the hallmark of Detroit's Black Lives Matter movement. And most of the time, out in front of them, was Nikia Wallace. Here she is addressing a crowd of hundreds atop the monument to Joe Louis, the iconic black fist in Detroit's Hart Plaza.
This is what violence!
It's what violence!
And police brutality!
And police brutality!
Looks like!
A lot has happened to Wallace since that first week of protesting. She helped co-found Detroit Will Breathe, a collective that's been the main hub for the city's Defund the Police movement. And she was arrested, a lot, charged with disorderly conduct and various traffic infractions stemming from the month-long street marches. Wallace says she's been targeted by law enforcement from the beginning.
There just wasn't any evidence that we committed any crimes or that we did anything other than challenge the policies and practices of the Detroit Police Department.
Wallace says the arrests themselves are illegal, too. So last August, she and Detroit Will Breathe went to federal court and sued the city, claiming the police violated their First Amendment rights.
We intend to hold them accountable for the harm that they caused, and we intend to make it so that officers in the city of Detroit cannot operate with impunity.
Lawsuits like this have shown up across the country since the killing of George Floyd. But Detroit is the only city to countersue the protesters. Here's Corporation Counsel Lawrence Garcia, Detroit's lead attorney, asking city council for funding to pursue the case earlier this year.
Whether there's a counterclaim or not, my office has to defend the city in the federal court case that involves Detroit Will Breathe.
Shortly thereafter, Detroit City Council approved a $200,000 contract to work with the law firm Clark Hill on the counter lawsuit. And so Nikia Wallace found herself on the defensive, sparring with the city in the legal arena over a slate of civil rights issues.
We knew from the beginning that the counterclaim was nothing but the continuation of a political witch hunt.
The cases have taken months to work their way through the criminal and civil court systems. On the criminal side of things, a local coalition of lawyers stepped in to offer free legal defense. Nancy A. Parker, a staff attorney with the Detroit Justice Center, is among them. She says the protesters did not break any laws.
They were simply out there protesting for human rights, civil rights, dignity for Black people, and that is why they were arrested.
Parker says the coalition has represented at least 279 people who were unlawfully arrested or ticketed during the protest. She says during their hearings, city prosecutors failed to provide specific video evidence or identify arresting officers.
None of those 279 defendants were a DPD officer able to say, I saw this person engaged in this unlawful act.
Many protesters were detained en masse and booked together by a single officer. And those are details the Defense Coalition leaned into. they filed motions to dismiss their clients' cases, a near total of 400 criminal charges, based on the insufficient discovery. And that was the argument Judge Larry Williams in the 36th District Court heard before he tossed out dozens of charges. Here he is on January 14th.
There's no way to make a case that, you know, the defendants could be proven beyond a reasonable doubt or responsible for the crimes in which they're charged with. There should be at least a record whether there was a body cam or not. But we don't even know who the arresting officers were at this point. So, I there's no point of going forward with any of these.
After Williams' decision, other judges followed suit, and prosecutors did a 180. By the end of January, city attorneys announced they would dismiss hundreds of charges, citing the varying discretion exercised by officers when writing up citations. But Parker says that's a false narrative.
They were embarrassed. They were put to shame because we revealed they did not have any of this evidence.
City attorneys would not return calls for an interview. But as they began dismissing charges for some protesters, the cases against certain fixtures of the movement, like Nakia Wallace, remained unchanged. John Royal is the president of the National Lawyers Guild in Detroit, which is part of the Defense Coalition. He says the prosecution was trying to intimidate the movement.
And what we were told by representatives of the city law department is that those were cases they were not dismissing because they considered them to be leaders.
Royal says many of the remaining charges were against individuals also listed as plaintiffs in the federal civil rights lawsuit against DPD and the city. That's where the facts of the criminal courts intersect with the civil litigation. Julie Hurwitz is one of the attorneys representing Detroit Will Breathe in federal court. She says Detroit's countersuit references those pending charges.
They attempted to use the simple fact that they arrested our clients as the basis for claiming that they should be allowed to sue them for conspiring to engage in violent behavior.
Hurwitz says the city and its team of attorneys did not provide sufficient facts to support their counterclaim, which alleged the protest group had engaged in a civil conspiracy.
They failed to identify any acts committed by either Detroit Will Breathe or any of the individual plaintiffs that could even remotely support a claim for civil conspiracy under the law.
The federal courts agreed with that point, striking down Detroit's counter lawsuit permanently. In her opinion, Judge Lori Michelson wrote the city failed to establish the essential elements of their allegations. The ruling was a win for the protest movement. Outside of the federal court, Nakia Wallace's criminal charges were dismissed by a judge. Only a handful of charges stemming from the summer's protests remain. But Wallace says the latest legal victories should not detract from the broader fight.
This is a coordinated effort between law enforcement and city governments to make us pay for being leaders in the largest social movement in the history of the United States.
Detroit and its team of lawyers are making one last attempt to reverse the federal judge's decision. They have filed a motion for reconsideration, saying the court ignored the city's underlying complaint that protesters committed assault and battery against police officers. The words assault and battery are absent from Detroit's original 65-page counterclaim. As the litigation moves forward, attorneys for Detroit Will Breathe are asking the city for specific evidence. But based on recent experience, many are skeptical that Detroit's law department will deliver. I'm Eli Newman.
And one final note. Today, Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy said that no charges will be filed against officers who shot and killed Hakeem Littleton. His encounter with police happened on the city's northwest side last summer. Littleton pulled a gun during the interaction and was subsequently shot by police. The shooting had a catalytic effect during the Detroit Will Breathe protests. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you again tomorrow.